Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How's it going, friends? Welcome to episode 13 of Swim Podcast. Again, the someone who isn't me on this one is Alan Moore. This is actually part two of a two-hour conversation that we had when I went up to Northampton to the Lodge Studios. Big up Jay and Mark. And we sat there for 2 hours and just talked about magic and creativity. And in this second hour, we carry on that conversation, but we also take in things like H.P. Lovecraft and Alan's forthcoming novel, Jerusalem. It's an epic listen. If you haven't checked out part one, you should maybe do that first, which is episode 12. But, you know, just jump in whenever and try and digest everything, because it's an amazing one. He's an incredible man. And listening to him speak was a beautiful thing. And sitting and having a conversation with him about magic and these other things, which I'm really passionate about, was quite a blessing. So at some recent festivals and also online, people have been asking me a little bit about the mechanics of the actual podcast. Stuff like how I'm choosing who the guests are going to be. And you know, when I first started this at the start of 2016 in January, when I finally pulled my finger out and decided I needed to get round to doing this, as I'd been sort of talking about it for 18 months but hadn't actually put it into action, I just made a list of people that I really wanted to speak to that I found super interesting, people whose music I love, people whose writing I really love. And I've just kind of worked my way through it and I've been ticking them off. So I've been really lucky on that front. You know, I mean, you look at the list of episodes and I think it's pretty decent. The list is obviously a very long one and I'm just working my way through it steadily. So upcoming guests, I'm hoping to get Laura Jane Grace. That's happening at the end of this year. Also Marilyn Manson. I've done a bunch of interviews with him and also with Geordie or Twiggy. But that was very specifically about the anniversary of Antichrist Superstar, which I'll probably do as a podcast at some point. But I want to get out to LA because there's a few people lined up that I really want to speak to. I want to speak to Kat Von D. I want to speak to Tom DeLonge about his To The Stars project, which he's been working on, which is fascinating, I think. So yeah, there's a long list of people and I'm just kind of working my way through it. There's also people like Ozzy and Tony Iommi and Jimmy Page, which seem slightly unobtainable at this point. But, you know, I've interviewed them all before for my radio show, so I'm kind of hoping we can make it happen that they do a podcast as well, because I think it'd be great to have some of those people on Swim. As far as the mechanics go of recording it, it's all very compact, actually. I've got like an Olympus LS100 multi-track recorder, which is the size of like an iPhone 6 Plus stuck on top of another one. The thing has a couple of XLR inputs. It has phantom power. I can record everything cleanly. I just use a couple of separate Rode mics. And then once I've recorded it, it's super easy with that Olympus. You just plug it into my laptop, take the audio off of it, and then I edit it in Pro Tools. But as far as the editing actually goes, it's more a case of just taking out all the bits where there are huge pauses where I'm thinking about what I want to say next, or me going, and that's pretty much it. Apart from adjusting audio levels, it's pretty easy. Also, I've been asked a couple of times about what the music is at the start of every episode. And that was it's actually a piece of music called Atropos, which I wrote a while ago and demoed it at home. And it was actually for an art exhibition that I did a while ago with Serge Tanky and a bunch of other people, where you had to create separate paintings and then a piece of music to go with those. And then when people walked around the gallery, they had headphones on, and there was like a QR reader or whatever. And when they pointed their phone at it, it played the corresponding piece of music to each piece of art. So the music at the start is just the piece of music that I wrote for that. And it may even make an appearance on my band's next album in some form or another. I don't know, as an interlude, who knows. As far as the paintings go, I've been trying to post these sort of progress videos on Instagram, which is at Daniel P. Carter, which shows me kind of working on the paintings, because there's been a couple of times as well where people have been have seen my artwork and go, oh right, so what are you doing, are you like painting over Xeroxes and photocopies? And I was like, no, they're oil paintings with a bit of acrylic and ink and whatnot. Yeah, and it would kind of bum me out a little bit that, you know, I don't want all this recognition necessarily, but I just want people to know that these are paintings that I've worked on rather than just like photocopying or printing out something from the internet and just making a painting over the top of it. That's not what's happening. There's actually going to be a book that I'm doing with a company called Von Zoss in the near future, which is going to be like a book of my sketches. And I think I'm going to use a few of these Swim podcast cover portraits, because I guess because they're my most recent work, but also there's a lot going on with them, because oftentimes what I'll do is I'll write notes underneath and draw sigils and have little images that reference the person that I'm interviewing. And then I draw and then paint their portrait over the top of those. And some of that sometimes bleeds through a bit, which I think is a good analogy for what the podcast is itself. Anyway, I hope that clears up a few things. If you want to get in touch, hit me up at Daniel P. Carter on Twitter and Instagram, and also subscribe on iTunes. Leave us a nice review and a star rating. That would be brilliant. Anyway, enough of that. This is part two with Alan Moore.
I find it interesting as well that... I was just thinking, some of your most famous comic work was born during a period where things were really bleak,
yeah,
and oppressive, and I think, you know, everyone always says great art comes out of great suffering and or a reaction to it, and it just feels like it started making me, I was thinking about this earlier, I remember being in school in like sitting in a chemistry class and being shown a video about what's going to happen when nuclear war comes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like the conditioning at that point was, looking back on it now, it's mind-blowing.
Well, I can remember during the 1980s when the Cold War was definitely at its hottest.
Yeah.
I remember the jets taking off to bomb Libya, the roar of those bomber engines in the night sky. Hmm. You could hear them all over the country. Yes, and that was of course when The Wind Blows, the book and the film, yeah, were emerging. That was in the air then. The doubt that we would survive another decade, and I remember that at that time we'd got two small children, our daughters, and I had heard that the thing that was most frightening children was that their parents were too scared to even talk about the nuclear dilemma.
Hmm.
And that frightened children more than anything. So I tried to talk frankly and openly to my kids about what the situation was.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I was far from resolved in it myself. At that time, I was thinking, well, you know, like, if a nuclear war happened, what would that mean? And I thought, what that would mean is that, assuming that it wiped out most of the life on the planet, or made conditions intolerable for the rest of it, probably. Hmm. I said, what that would mean is that every human struggle, every childbirth, every non-human struggle, for that matter, all of it, all the art, all of the pain of childbirth, the difficulty and struggle of raising children, all of that, all the wars, everything would have all been for nothing.
Hmm.
And nobody would ever know that we'd ever existed. That was quite depressing. But I thought, well, we might get through that. We might get through the nuclear war thing. You know, we've got through things in the past. We might get through that. But then there is the environmental thing, isn't there? You know, we could easily just completely wipe out, you know, biological life upon this planet. And then we're back to the same position. Nobody would have ever known that we were here. But we might get through that. But then, I mean, like, looking at it, even the sun, what is it, in another 5 billion years, it kind of expands. We'll gobble up all of the inner planets, probably including Earth. But people like Eric Drexler, one of the godfathers of nanotechnology, he suggested solutions for that, that we could perhaps either prune the sun, solar husbandry, by having a ring of reactors, a ring of cyclotrons completely surrounding the sun, which would squeeze it in the middle so that blobs flew off at the end, which we could capture and then use as an energy source for the rest of time. But there again, that might not happen. But if it did, or if we managed to move to another planet that was outside of our expanding sun, even so, after a few more billion years, I mean, like, the universe itself is going to inevitably die, and nobody would ever know that we were even here. So this was pretty big stuff, and it remained unresolved until I finally came up with the working thesis for Jerusalem, which I've since learned is referred to as eternalism, but which I believe has a profound scientific basis. This is the idea that all physicists since Einstein have agreed that we are in a universe of at least 4 spatial dimensions. And they are spatial dimensions because that's what a dimension is. It's a measurement of space according to a particular plane. So we've got a universe of at least 4 spatial dimensions, one of which is not time, but rather our perception of time is the way that we perceive the 4th spatial dimension.
Okay.
So according to Einstein, we are existing in what is called a block universe. This is a huge hyperdimensional solid in which everything is unchanging and eternal, and which the illusion of change and the illusion of movement only comes about as our consciousness moves through the solid along what we might call the time axis, in which the effect is something like running a projector beam over a strip of film. Now, on the strip of film, all of those individual cells, they are unmoving, they are unchanging, they are fixed in position forever, or at least until the film combusts or whatever. But when the beam of the projector plays over them, then there is the illusion of movement and change and narrative and Charlie Chaplin beating the bully and getting the girl and doing his funny walk. And there is the illusion of a life. I suspect that that could be our situation. And of course, when we get to the end of that life, our consciousness, as far as I can see, has nowhere to go in this unchanging solid other than back to the beginning.
Yeah.
Which would lead to an infinite recurrence, and every time would still feel like the first time.
Yeah.
And that, although, yeah, people have received that idea with mixed reactions. My daughter Leah said, yeah, I think I could live with that. Ian Banks, although it was a particularly rough time in his life, he said, Jesus Christ, that's the most horrible thing I've ever heard. And yeah, I can see that, because what you're talking about, the best moments of your life forever, I mean, that's paradise.
Yeah.
the worst moments of your life forever, that is hell. Both here and now, both happening at the same time, both almost inseparable from each other. Yeah, one of the things it does, though, is it removes that thing of, and then nobody would know we were ever here. It doesn't matter. We've not gone anywhere. And in fact, about halfway through Jerusalem, I found this beautiful quote from Einstein. It's actually a little more beautiful than what he actually said. People have tidied it up a bit. But in the tidied up version, Einstein was talking to the widow. He was consoling the widow of a fellow physicist. This was only a few months before Einstein himself died. But consoling the widow of this fellow physicist, he said, look, for people like myself and your husband, death is not really a major problem because we understand the persistent illusion of transience, which is a beautiful phrase. It's five words long, and if I'd heard that before I started Jerusalem, I probably could have saved myself some 600,000 plus words, you know. Yeah, that solves all of that stuff. Yeah. It means that, yeah, nothing, that time is not vanishing, that you know, the fact that they don't make Spangles anymore, the fact that all of the good television shows seem to have disappeared, the fact that they've pulled down your favourite buildings, that's okay, because they're all still intact, just down the road. Back there down the road. Like the houses that you drive by in a car, they're not demolished the moment that you go past them. If you backed up, they'd still be there. And I think that that is the nature of time.
Yeah.
So that was one of the things that enabled me to resolve a lot of those feelings. That's not to say that I wouldn't be terribly upset if there was a nuclear war tomorrow, but I wouldn't be quite as despairing as I would have been otherwise.
Yeah.
You know?
It feels like that that oppressive fear is becoming really prevalent again, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, in the, for want of a better word, the psychic sphere, that we are under oppressively heavy weather at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I was going to say it feels like the same thing, but dressed up in another manner.
But, and this is perhaps just me trying to make the best of a nightmarish situation, but, as you were remarking earlier, I don't believe necessarily that all art comes from suffering. Because, but perhaps a true artist should have an understanding of suffering, even if they have not necessarily suffered themselves. I mean, like Goya is Horrors of the Civil War. If he had actually been one of those dismembered bodies stuck on a tree branch, then he wouldn't have done the pictures.
Yeah.
It's not important that he suffered, but that he saw or witnessed or was able to conceive the suffering and to pass it on to us.
Yeah.
It's, I think that there's, you know, that is, I'm sorry, I've lost my thread completely. What were we just saying?
About that great art can come out of suffering, but that you don't actually have to.
Yeah, it's sort of that
you suffer yourself.
And yeah, all right, okay, I'm back on track. When I go to a sub clause of a sentence, and I tend to forget where I originally started.
Yeah,
but basically, it is true that times of turbulence do produce wonderful art as a reaction. I mean, like the Renaissance itself was sparked by the fall of Constantinople. Incredible turbulence and warfare, but that released all of these ideas to a Western world that had never seen them before. I hadn't seen them for centuries.
Yeah.
I remember the late 70s and the early 80s. Yes, Margaret Thatcher was a terrible, terrible thing to happen to a country. On the other hand, it did give an incredible focus to punk, to the alternative comedy scene, to alternative thinking in general.
Yeah.
These things have counter-reactions.
Yeah.
It's like in Jerusalem, I describe reality as all being decided by a bunch of snooker-playing archangels. At this enormous snooker table, it's all about rebounds and volleys and repercussions, and I tend to think that, I mean, it's like when I was doing From Hell, the book about the Whitechapel Jack the Ripper murders.
Yeah,
I mean, in that, I believe it was George Bernard Shaw who said, "All of us social reformers have been slaving for years to try and get people to improve conditions for the poor, and now some anonymous genius has beaten us to it." Now, I think that that may have been imparting motives to Jack the Ripper, which he probably, whoever he was probably not feeling. But it is true that the horrific death of those five women, that brought attention to the East End, and a realisation of the conditions in which all of the people in the East End were living, and that brought improvements to the area.
Yeah.
It brought a different way of looking at the poor. So these things, sometimes terrible things happen that as repercussions have what good things happening, and the other way around.
Yeah. But you do you think they're necessities?
Well, in my view of the universe, when I was just talking about this block universe unchanging throughout eternity, the one thing that would preclude would be free will. Yeah. It would suggest that everything, our every action, our every word, the movement of every molecule is determined. I mean, this is, it's known as a block universe, as a solid. Yeah, like I say, that would preclude free will, which would mean some quite big changes for all of us. I mean, science could still function, although I would think that you'd have to change your notions of cause and effect.
Yeah, but then we're just like Skeletrix cars stuck on a track just going round and round.
Yeah, and that would be the case, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Or we're like characters in a film or in a novel.
Yeah.
That have our appointed roles, that all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players.
Yeah.
At which point, I mean, I would say, I mean, yeah, so you'd lose cause and effect in how does one thing cause another if it's all going to happen anyway? You'd also, for most of the world's religions, they'd have a problem because you also lose sin and virtue.
Yeah.
Which really goes against the grain for all of us. Are we, because, you know, we like hating Hitler. We like hating Boris Johnson and Nigel Farage. However, if they were merely acting out their part in a predetermined universe, then ultimately you would have to say that they were not at fault. I mean, I've investigated this in Jerusalem, and I've come to the conclusion that, the bad are not truly sinful and the good are not truly virtuous except to us.
Yeah, because then it just becomes like a giant cosmic version of I was just following orders.
Yes, exactly. So, but except to us, we are the only people perceiving morality.
Yeah.
So we are free to attribute that morality how we will. It may not ultimately, on a cosmic level, be of any meaning.
Yeah.
But then, who said it was anyway? So we are still left with feelings of sin and virtue and guilt. And in fact, the only way that we can overcome that, the idea that you mentioned of being on our scalextric track, the only way we can overcome that and not go mad is because we don't really believe that we don't have free will. And how could you tell the difference? It's we will continue to believe, as long as we have the illusion of free will, we're all right. As long as nobody writes a, say, 1,300-page book explaining that that is all an illusion, then we should be okay.
But then it brings into question all the current theories that are coming through now, in where they're saying the universe is, the whole universe is a hologram. And
yes, that was one that I had particular fun with. That one, it was there was two actually. There was that was the one that was based upon somewhere in, I think, Frankfurt. They were doing some experiments and they were getting unusual noise that they were picking up.
Yeah.
And someone had written to them saying, I think, does your noise that you're picking up in your results, is it roughly within these parameters? And they said, yeah, it's exactly in those parameters. And he said, I think I know what it might be, but I'm going to have to come over and have a look. And this person put forward the idea that what the noise was the universal constant, which I believe is the smallest grain of the universe that can possibly exist. It's sort of the infinitely tiny grain of the universe, the universal constant. This scientist was saying, yeah, but it shouldn't be detectable. This is the same mathematically, this is the universal constant, but it is so big that we're able to detect it. That could only be happening if it was being projected from a point outside the boundaries of the current universe. And that this would work if that basically a hologram is a flat surface that causes a three-dimensional image to appear. He was saying that the outside skin of the universe, if you like, which could be regarded as a two-dimensional surface, the limits of the universe,
yeah,
that could be regarded as a two-dimensional surface. What if the entirety of the universe is in fact a hologram? Yeah, this is possible. This is the thing about our present day, is that we have all of these beautiful bonkers ideas that we can entertain. There was also the people who said that, look, within the next 20 years we're definitely going to invent a quantum supercomputer that will be able to handle more information, more bits of information than there are particles in the known universe.
Yeah.
At that point, we will be able to simulate an entire universe full of simulated life forms that do not know that they are simulated. And he pointed out that if we're going to be able to do that, the odds that this is the first time that this has happened are vanishingly small.
Yeah.
It is much more likely that we are within a simulation within a simulation within a simulation within a simulation, and so on.
Like a fractal.
An infinitely nested series of simulated universes. And he said, so what should you do? Given this, how can the average human being put this to his advantage? And he was saying, well, firstly, you should always try, you should remember that it's the boring characters who get killed off first. So try to be interesting. That this is probably a good ploy. Also, whoever is in the next simulated universe up is playing this game, this simulation that we're in, is to us effectively God.
Yeah.
They are also probably, given that they are probably have a similar ego structure to ourselves, they are probably playing in the game as some sort of avatar. Now, they probably wouldn't go for an obvious avatar, such as, say, the President of the United States, but would probably still go for a celebrity of some sort. And Josie Long, when she was doing her Arts Emergency guerrilla performances up and down the country in drafty car parks, she was doing one in Milton Keynes, and she asked me if I wanted to go over and talk to the people. It was an area behind a church. She contacted the audience by Twitter.
Yeah.
Completely free. It was just saying, look, we can just put on actually quite entertaining performances wherever we want. So she'd got some musicians and comedians. It was great. And then I went along and explained that sort of about what I've just told you about how God is. I mean, this man was essentially saying that we should suck up to minor celebrities because they might be God, basically. So I was explaining that to the frozen and huddled people of Milton Keynes, and I was saying that that really wasn't enough because, I mean, a lot of celebrities are terribly unpleasant, and that I thought that if they were trying to decide which minor celebrity was God, they should probably go for one who sounded and perhaps looked a bit like their image of what God might look like. And I said, but that in itself was not enough, really, because that could lead you to genuflecting before any tramp, basically. You know, so you need other criteria. And I said to the people of Milton Keynes that they should ask themselves whether this figure before them actually physically constructed the world around them. And then I revealed to the people of Milton Keynes that actually I had physically constructed the world of Milton Keynes when I was working for a subcontractor to the gas board in the mid-70s when they were building Milton Keynes. So yes, I did physically create their universe. And this is why, to this day, I am worshipped as a deity by the primitive and superstitious people of Milton Keynes.
You know what is funny, though, to say that, is that that makes me think of when you wrote V for Vendetta. That's playing out now, isn't it? You have the Occupy movement, you have Anonymous, you have people donning Guy Fawkes masks, and it's brought it into a reality.
Well, yeah.
Feel about that?
Well, personally, I've disowned all of my early comics work. I don't have a copy of V for Vendetta in the house.
That's really good.
And the same with I've heard that it's got its points, but no, it's just that all of these books, V for Vendetta, Watchmen, all of the stuff that I don't own, it largely represents to me broken friendships, copyright theft, all sorts of things that aren't very pleasant, and which, if I were to spend my life thinking about them, I'd probably be quite angry most of the time, and I'd choose not to do that. So don't have copies of them in the house. But with the phenomena that you're talking about, the it was a bit strange with V for Vendetta that, I was writing that in 1982 and was trying to project this unbelievable future date of 1997, which was clearly never going to happen.
Yeah.
And I thought, right, how do I conjure up a fascist dystopia? And I thought, well, one way would be to put security cameras on every corner. That looks pretty fascist. And then, of course, in 1997, Tony Blair got in and immediately started blanketing the country with security cameras. Whether he had been a fan of Viva Vendetta in his early days, I don't know. I hope not. It's always possible. And then, I mean, that felt a bit strange because you think, all right, it's probably just a coincidence. But on the other hand, it does feel a bit as if an idea that I had in a ridiculous science fiction context has somehow leaked out into the real world. This is obviously a delusion, but it's still a strange feeling. Then when the Anonymous movement first started and I first experienced them, I've recently read a very, very good book which is called, I think, Hackers, Hoaxers, Whistleblowers and Spies by Gabriella Coleman. Which is about the evolution of Anonymous and LulzSec and AntiSec and all of those groups. It's my first memory is of them, people in V for Vendetta masks, barracking the Scientologists in Tottenham Court Road. I'm not sure how long ago, because past time tends to sort of telescope for me, and I'm no longer certain of which decade things happened in. But I thought, well, that's interesting. I'm glad that somebody has found a use for that mask. I'm glad that if it's a modern protest movement, I'm glad that that face is useful to them, that image.
And appropriate for Scientology as well.
Well, I mean, this apparently I think that the whole of the Anonymous movement kind of came together around its attacks on Scientology.
I didn't know that.
Apparently so. It's I mean, originally it was anti-Scientology, but the kind of the working methods that they evolved, I think that they very quickly realised that actually you could apply that to almost any target. And when they'd achieved some sort of victory to some degree over Scientology, in that Scientology now is unable to silence and sue people in the way that it used to, it's probably on the ropes to a certain degree. They then went on to play a massive part in, giving all that information to WikiLeaks. They were originally the source of it. They also played a part that I hadn't realised in the Arab Spring. That apparently 2 or 3 days before all of that kicked off in Tunisia, Anonymous had been working. They'd been running Op Tunisia, which was basically releasing data, hacking government files in Tunisia, releasing the data, fomenting the revolution. Apparently 2 or 3 days before it all broke out, there were school children in a playground in Tunisia, all lining up wearing V for Vendetta masks. And then after Tunisia had kicked off, they moved on to Op Egypt. And so on. It is something, and there is the sense that this idea has somehow escaped from my mind into reality. And I do believe that the boundary between fiction and reality is a porous one. I think that this is how magic works or seems to work. That sort of, and I think it's indeed how the world works. How everything around us, all the technologies, the money in our pockets, everything, has been invented in a human mind. That we are actually living in the interior of our own minds. All the artifacts, everything, the language that we're speaking in. Everything has come from a human mind through this semi-permeable membrane. And I was at a... Now, having read Gabriella Coleman's book, I realised that most of a large number of those protesters have never read V for Vendetta. They mostly saw the film. Which I suppose, but if that was what got the idea across, although I am rather sick of being quoted with bits of lame dialogue from that film being attributed to me, people should.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Not fear their governments. Government should fear their people. I never said that. That was one of the people who wrote the film. But so I don't, and also I'm not out there doing any of this stuff. So I definitely don't want to take credit for any of this. This is purely down to the individuals themselves. They deserve all the credit,
of course. But to create a symbol that becomes a rallying point.
Well, I had. I attended a talk somewhere in London. This was some years ago. It was to a kind of an occult sort of.
It was the Moot with No Name.
That would be the one.
Atlantis Bookshop.
Yes.
Upstairs in the pub.
Yes. Were you there?
I was.
Yeah. I spoke to somebody afterwards.
Yeah.
I didn't speak to you afterwards, did I?
No.
I spoke to somebody afterwards who was saying that they were saying that the existence of Anonymous and how this was rippling across the world, they were saying that this meant that I was the greatest magus of all time, that I was better than John Dee, and I was saying, no, that's... It's these people who deserve the credit. It's not all down to me. I'm very happy if I've provided an idea or an image. And what I was thinking was, even in the remote possibility that what you're saying is true, why would I want anybody to know that?
Yeah.
You know? In those moments, I am... reminded of a story by the American science fiction writer Algis Budrys. He wrote a short story called Nobody Bothers Gus, where he's got somebody who's noticed that a particular baseball player is hitting them out of the park every time, is doing superhuman things out there on the baseball field, and nobody's really talking about it. Nobody seems to notice. And he gets a chance to talk to this person, and the guy is saying, I suppose I can tell you because you'll forget it immediately anyway. He says, I can do this stuff. And there's other autograph hunters around, and one of them has got gives him a pen and a piece of paper, and the player picks up the pen, ignores the paper, picks up the pen, and with his fingernail, he signs his name a millimetre under the surface of the pen, and gives it back to the autograph hunter, who just says, "Oh, neat," and goes off with it. And the protagonist of the story is just gaping at this, and he explains, look, I don't want a lot of fuss. People just forget that I've done this marvellous thing because I like a quiet life. And I could sympathise with that. And I am definitely not saying that I have created the anonymous movement through supernatural powers.
Of course.
I'm just saying that even if I had, why would I want to broadcast that?
Yeah.
You know?
Plus it throws up everything into... It goes back round to the idea of art as magic and magic as art then. But also everything else then becomes horrific when you think about it. I was... obviously, I'm going through Providence at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and it's made me go back and read Lovecraft again, which I hadn't done because I remember I got into his work when I was really young, just through and it, in really silly ways as well. Like I found out about him through liking Metallica because they had a couple of songs. Mm-hmm. They had The Call of Cthulhu and they had The Thing That Should Not Be. And also through the role-playing game.
Yeah.
And from that, you know, then started reading his work. So reading... I'll be honest, I only read The Courtyard and Neonomicon fairly recently, actually, after the fact of getting into Providence. But, as soon as you start to look at... his thing, it then started making me then look into other things, like, you know, as you were saying about Kenneth Grant,
mm-hmm.
Saying that, you know, the idea that there was some kind of link between Lovecraft and Crowley
intuiting something,
which is essentially going back to what we said initially about how art is created, like where does art come from, where does writing mm-hmm. come from.
I mean, like, I would say that it's a valid idea, I guess, but it's just that Lovecraft was such a fierce rationalist. And now I know Kenneth Grant gets around that by saying he didn't know that he was channeling these things that are real. Now you kind of, I think it's more complex than that. The thing is, Lovecraft came up with all of these things purely out of his own imagination.
Yeah.
That they had got enormous resonance because Lovecraft was almost an unbearably sensitive barometer of what I suppose you might call American dread. He was frightened about everything. He was awkward with women. He was frightened of immigrants. Or despised them, if there's any difference. But also, other than these average middle-class fears of his time, Lovecraft was reading science magazines, and he understood the revolution that was going on in science, how Einstein had practically undone the whole of humanity's conception of where it stood in the universe and had rewritten a lot of the basic rules of the universe. And I think Lovecraft was initially horrified by Einstein, but then came to absorb his theories and probably to understand them. It seems that he has understood, and he's taken them on board. So what Lovecraft's fiction was reflecting was that we existed in a hostile, random universe. Not so much hostile as completely oblivious.
Yeah.
A universe so vast that we were reduced to the tiniest, most insignificant speck in a remote corner of this infinite blackness. And Lovecraft was looking at a world without God. He was a fierce atheist. He was looking at a world that had occurred by random accident. This infinite universe, and the feeling that gave him as a human being, the existential horror, if you like, of that sensation, it was that he personified in his various cosmic extraterrestrial creatures, his gods. I mean, most of them, a lot of them are referred to as mindless, which is another way of saying, yet random, without intention.
Yeah.
They're just there, these random forces. I think that Lovecraft was trying to chart the horrors of the rational universe. And actually, I think a lot of the theories that I've read, some of the occultists that have become interested in Lovecraft seem to be expecting the great old ones or something very much like them to manifest upon Earth very, very shortly.
Yeah.
In any material sense, that is not going to happen. I think I can be fairly confident about that. You know,
yeah.
I think it also diminishes what Lovecraft himself was doing. I think he's an incredibly important writer, but it's nothing to do with him as a conduit for magical forces. I think that the magic of Lovecraft was that he somehow managed to be a willful antiquarian who was also a closeted modernist, that he railed against people like Joyce and Gertrude Stein and T.S. Eliot. He wrote a brilliant parody of The Wasteland called Waste Paper, which is actually a good poem and quite funny in its kind of parody of what Lovecraft saw as Eliot's nonsense. But at the same time, Lovecraft was himself a modernist, even if he was closeted. You look at some of his stuff, there's invented linguistics, there are first person rushes of delirious narrative. He's using a lot of modernist tricks. He's certainly a lot more modern than his idol Pope.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the ideas that are there purely Lovecraft's own. And towards the end of his career, he was coming up with a fusion of horror and science fiction that was utterly unique. You know, he hated a lot of horror, contemporary horror stories, because they didn't really add up to his idea of a weird story.
Yeah.
He thought they were too human, too provincial in their imagining of horrors. He also hated a lot of science fiction stories with, you know, the alien races who all spoke English. They were all pretty much the same as humans in their ambitions and what they did and how they acted. He despised that. So by combining science fiction and horror in the way that he did in At the Mountains of Madness or The Shadow Out of Time or The Colour Out of Space, he was doing something really new that invigorated both genres, you know. That, I think, is Lovecraft's importance, and the fact that even today I still think that people could do with looking at H.P. Lovecraft, because he's not a dusty, old, dead author.
Yeah.
I think that his material and his processes, his techniques, they are still really valuable, really useful. I have been reading an awful lot of Lovecraft criticism.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you start to notice these things that Lovecraft does, like his description of Cthulhu. He said, while it would be accurate to describe it as some combination of an octopus, a dragon, and a man, it was nevertheless the overall outline that was most disturbing. So he tells you, yeah, it was kind of like a combination of an octopus, a dragon, and a man, but it wasn't really like that.
Yeah.
I can't really tell you what it was like. It was something about the overall outline. Or describing The Colour Out of Space in one, I think, brilliant line. He said, Indeed, it was only a colour by analogy. What is that? I mean, what was it? A smell? Was it a texture?
Yeah.
What? It's sort of
like synesthesia. Yeah.
The only thing that actually exists that is that has colour by analogy would be a quark. Quarks have colour, but it doesn't. We term that colour. It's analogous.
Yeah.
But of course, Lovecraft would have known nothing of quarks.
Yeah.
He did understand the beginnings of quantum physics impoorly. Imprecisely. That's a real word. Impoorly isn't a word, is it? He understood the beginnings of quantum physics imprecisely. But I don't think he'd have known about quantum particles being said to have colour.
Yeah.
You know. But still, you know, a tremendous writer who, despite his obsession with the past, offers us some interesting ways of looking at and dealing with the future.
Yeah. And to work collaboratively as well as he did with people like Clark Ashton Smith and August Derleth, and obviously they came after him, but they started to use bits of their creations amongst his and vice versa.
It's kind of that's in itself a kind of an interesting thing. One of the things that I wrote in my outline for when I was doing Providence and some of the related stuff that is around it was that there is no Cthulhu mythos. That does not exist.
Mm.
Lovecraft never used that term.
Yeah.
Originally Derleth,
yeah.
The eager fanboy,
yeah.
Suggested that Lovecraft refer to his mythos, which Lovecraft didn't think of it as a mythos, but he suggested it should be called the mythos of Hastur. And Lovecraft pointed out, well, actually, Hastur, I didn't really invent Hastur. He comes from Robert Chambers and Ambrose Bierce. So, anyway, Lovecraft referred to what he did as his Cthulhuism or his Yog-Sothothery. And he said it's basically a bit of fun. And also, if he could get other writers to mention his gods and creepy books, and vice versa, if he could mention theirs, then to readers coming across those stories, it would add an element of depth to the story, because the readers would think, hang on, I read about this god in a story by Robert E. Howard. Are both of these writers taking from some mythology that I've not heard of?
Yeah.
Can this Necronomicon thing really be real?
Of course.
And so I've got 4 copies of the Necronomicon at home.
Yeah.
All of them complete fabrications.
Yeah.
But the
Simon one is sold like 800,000 copies. It's not...
That has been continuously in print since it was invented as a kind of nasty joke.
Yeah.
By the people at the Magical Child Bookshop in New York, was it?
Yeah. Allegedly so, yeah.
Well, as from what I understand, they originally came up with... They'd got a kind of an occult studies group based around the bookshop.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, this will be a really good way of sorting them out, because if they know anything about magic, they'll realise that you don't do books of magic without the banishing spells. And, of course, they'll notice that we've based a lot of this upon the obviously fictitious works of H.P. Lovecraft. And then put out this book of actual Babylonian magical spells and charms. And that book, irrespective of whether it has any magical power or not, has... You will find out, I think, in Providence 11. It has been at the site of at least 2 real-life satanic murders.
Yeah.
It's not important what the book is. It's what people believe it is.
Yeah, what it represents, yeah.
Yeah, and there's also talk from people in the magical community. They are very uncomfortable about the book. Apparently some people in relation to the book have had a sense, more than one person has had a sense of a vision of a wall with something hammering upon it from the other side. Does this mean Cthulhu and or something like him is real? No, but we create these things.
Yeah.
Where do any of the gods come from originally other than in a human mind?
Hmm.
We create these things, but as Joel Barocco said about the Chaos Magicians hypothesis that you could worship or conjure up Cthulhu or Yog-Sothoth or Nyarlathotep. And Joel Barocco said, yeah, I suppose you could, but why would you? Which is a good point.
Yeah.
You know, why try to summon up something that is perceived in entirely negative terms? Something to which human life is completely, you know, beneath regard. That wouldn't sound like the best idea to me. I'd say if you're going to summon up something, summon up something that's friendly and positive and perhaps useful.
Hmm. But then that's essentially what's happening now as well with the singularity and AI, I think. This is a totally different thing, but it just made me think of that.
Well, I mean, like, the thing is...
Sorry to take you off track.
I don't know about the singularity. I mean, like, I myself have talked about the... it was a French economist whose name I can never remember, or I think he was French, who came up with the concept of period information doubling.
Yeah.
Which is that you start from the first hand axe, say that's, what, 100,000 BC, something like that. And then you take that up to 1 BC, 1 AD, the year dot. And you say, right, how many inventions have we come up with in that time?
Yeah.
We're going to call that one period of human information. And then we're going to see how long it takes to double that. And actually it takes about 1,500 years, which is a big difference from the 100,000 years that the first period took. We've doubled it by about the time of the Renaissance. And it keeps getting faster.
Yeah, it becomes geometric.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, it's between 1960 and 1970, I believe information doubled. And I, as far as I know, the last time I checked, it was doubling about every 18 months. That was probably like where it intersected with Moore's Law. And this itself was years ago.
Hmm.
And I know that there was a projected point around 2017 where we would be doubling human information every fraction of a second. That means that every fraction of a second we would be acquiring more human, more information than had existed in the entirety of human history before that point.
Yeah.
What kind of civilization or even human being might exist on the other side of that transition? I cannot imagine.
Yeah.
I don't know about... I mean, the idea of a singularity, I don't know. I don't know if that particular graph is holding up. It might be doing something weird. It might have reached a peak. I don't know. The thing about AI is something that I am much more sceptical about. As far as I understand it, the Turing test, which originally was the imitation game, and originally was Alan Turing basically kind of saying, look, if you've got a man and a woman behind these two slits, and if a human interrogator could not tell which was the man and which was the woman, then what is that saying about identity? And you could see why Alan Turing would be driven to ask those questions.
Yeah.
And of course, later he extended it to the Turing test. Now, the thing about the Turing test, as I understand it, is it's not, yes, it is our best way of testing for artificial, for genuine artificial intelligence, for a self-aware machine, which is what we're talking about. But I think that what Turing was doing was actually kind of pointing out that, yes, this is the best way to test for an intelligent, aware machine, and this way is completely useless. We cannot even prove that another human being is sentient and aware in the same way that we are.
Yeah.
We can't.
Yeah.
So what Turing was saying was basically, yeah, this is the, as good as it gets. Somebody standing behind two slits and making a guess. That is the Turing test. This is as good as it gets.
Yeah.
And I was, again, reading in this week's New Scientist, which is, it was quite a good issue. But they were talking about the AI winter, which they fear will be coming soon, as predictions about AI completely outstrip the capabilities. We do not have... We've got things like DeepMind, which did pretty well on that game of Go a couple of months ago. That is a massive step forward. It's a massive step forward from the chess-playing computers.
Hmm.
And there was the Watson that won on Jeopardy. The thing is, you don't have to be aware to do these things. You just have to be able to process a lot of information accurately. It doesn't know that it's doing it.
Hmm.
And I suspect that the idea that consciousness emerges from complexity, yeah, it's an interesting idea. We have no proof of it. I believe British Telecom, they got about 10 years ago, they got really worried by the idea of emergent consciousness from complexity. They thought, what if the internet suddenly gains consciousness?
Hmm.
So they went around, they spent millions testing to see if the internet had become conscious until they realised, actually, no, we can't even tell that other human beings are conscious. So, yeah. So they abandoned it.
Yeah.
It's, I'm not sure about that. I don't think that it's necessary that complexity alone is enough to create consciousness. I don't know where consciousness comes from. I'm not saying it comes from somewhere mystical. I'm saying I don't know where it comes from. So given that, the chances of ever duplicating it, we'd have to be very, very lucky, and we're not doing it. What we do have is immensely useful things like, say, niche AIs. There's a niche AI that is currently running the Hong Kong traffic system because it knows where all the work gangs are, where all the faults have been reported. It knows how distant... It can sort everything out brilliantly and efficiently.
Yeah.
And I think that offers a lot of possibilities because presumably the Hong Kong traffic system, that sounds like quite a complicated thing. as does, say, government. If we only need an administration, why not put in a couple of niche AIs to handle everything? Because actually they're not going to be fiddling their expenses, are they? They're not going to be following their own bonkers right-wing agendas. Skynet aside, I don't think we have much to worry about from machines. They just do what we tell them to do.
You know?
But I think that...
Sorry, I threw a real spanner in the works then.
But it's like, I think that ultimately artificial intelligence, the idea of artificial intelligence might be the most useful thing about it. Because by contemplating that idea, we are actually thinking about our own intelligence. We're thinking about, by thinking about a non-human intelligence, that forces us to consider what human intelligence is and what human consciousness is. Like a lot of these things, the thing itself is not half as useful as the idea of the thing.
Yeah.
Look at holograms, for example. I mean, we were told back in the 70s that holograms were going to change everything, that it was all going to be like Princess Leia in that little bit in Star Wars, you know. What holograms tended to be used for in actuality was, I remember that they were giveaways in Shreddies. which was my breakfast cereal of choice at the time.
Yeah.
Because actually, you know, once you've seen them, yeah, it looks nice. It's a nice 3D shape. It's an interesting principle. But it's the principle that's the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like the it gives birth to ideas like the one we were discussing earlier.
Yeah.
Is the entire of the universe some kind of hologram? It also brings up interesting metaphors and analogies, like, for example, the idea that if you have a hologram of a rose and you smash it, a blurred image of the whole rose will appear in every fragment. I've heard that that is true.
Yeah.
That says something about the potential structure of the universe that is quite comforting. It's suggesting that in all of us, the image of the in everything, the entirety of the universe is somehow represented.
Yeah.
Like the self-similarity in fractals. You know,
where every man and woman is a star.
Yes. It would. That is quite a nice positive doctrine.
Yeah.
And I suspect that that kind of doctrine will ultimately be more useful than the giveaways in the Shreddies packets. You know, just my opinion.
All right, brilliant. We've got, let me check. I don't want to keep you that.
Yeah, what's the time now?
That's 2 hours.
Really? Is it 4 o'clock now?
Hmm. Yeah.
We've probably one more question, if that worked for you.
Do you know what? We can wrap it up now if that's good with you.
Are you sure?
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad if you've covered everything you wanted to ask.
Well, no, to be honest with you, I could sit and listen to you talk for fucking days, if I'm honest with you. Because well, I find it fascinating and enlightening. But yeah, that's great.
Yeah, well, obviously, I have a lot of time to sit around thinking about this stuff, so sort of...
I think more people should do that.
Well, you know, they might come to some interesting conclusions.
Most definitely.
It's... I suppose I've got an arts lab meeting tonight. I've started up an arts lab.
Okay.
It was in, last November, we had a day of counterculture.
Yeah.
Up at the... Well, prior to that, our local... He's a local politician, and he was an MP at one point, a Labour MP. He's the only local politician that I've really got any time for. And he was the only Labour MP, or the only MP ever, to have an Intercity Firm tattoo, which I think is brilliant.
Yeah.
And so, but he was talking to some of the young people up at the college who wanted to engage with politics but didn't really have... They didn't like any of the options that they could see.
Hmm.
So they'd heard that I'll go on about anarchy at the drop of a hat and alternative politics. So they got me up to talk to them, and there was only about, less than a dozen of them there. But we had a great talk in which about 10 minutes in, it became glaringly apparent that they hadn't got the first clue what I was talking about, because I was using familiar references to me as part of a counterculture.
Yeah.
And then I was having to explain them to them while they looked, because they'd never known a counterculture.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the hypothesis in John Higgs' book, John Higgs' brilliant book, The KLF, Chaos, Magic, and the Band That Burned a Million Quid.
Yeah.
Where he is saying that, we used to have a counterculture since the end of the Second World War. We'd reliably have a new counterculture every 2 or 3 years, as regular as buses, you know. And this more or less continued till the end of Rave, which was roughly in 1990, when the KLF left their dead sheep on the steps of the Brit Awards. And Bill Drummond sprayed the audience with machine gun fire blanks, and they announced that the KLF had left the music industry. And you can more or less date the end of Rave from that colourful point.
Yeah.
And then we waited for 5 years, and we got Britpop, we got something that wasn't a counterculture, something that was imposed from the top down, something which was a composite of the past 30 or 40 years of English guitar band music.
Which
guaranteed to appeal to people like me, which is why I hated it so much, because it was so transparently aimed at people of my generation. Whereas I thought, actually, younger people should have music and counterculture of their own. So we had this big thing up at the college. It was brilliant. We had Robin Ince there, Grace Petrie, Francesca Martinez, John Higgs, Scroobius Pip, me and Melinda, and a fantastic array of people. And we talked about counterculture, and at the end of it, somebody put up their hand in the first row when I said, any questions? And they said, yeah, is there any way that I can stay here and not go home to a life where I feel that nobody ever has these opinions but me? And I said, yeah, that's a really good question. Perhaps if everybody who wants to take this forward in some ambiguous way gives their details to the young gentleman standing over there, and we'll see what happens. And what happened was, we, about 16 of us, got together in December last year and spent the first meeting trying to decide where we would have the second meeting, and also what we were going to call ourselves. I'd suggested we could call ourselves an arts lab, although I understand if you younger people, perhaps that's got too much 1960s baggage. So let's hear your suggestions. And yeah, that was the rest of the meeting taken up with everybody's suggestions. So the second meeting, which was in January, it was freezing cold and only about five people turned up. And I said, well, this is a bit disappointing in terms of turnout, but on the other hand, this does enable us to stage a coup. So I'm going to suggest that in lieu of any better ideas, that we call ourselves Northampton Arts Lab, because that's what David Bowie would have wanted. And one of the guys there said, are you actually going to play that card? And I said, yes, I am. So, yeah, now we're Northampton Arts Lab. We brought out our first magazine about a month ago, which looks gorgeous. Best Arts Lab magazine ever.
Yeah,
we've got about, I think, 60 or 70 members. We did our first gig on the 24th of June. We'd forgotten that this was the day after the referendum. And yet it turned out to be eerily appropriate. It sort of, I ended the evening, that whole evening was about, it was called Artmageddon, and it was about how, yeah, when the apocalypse turned up eventually, it wasn't the one we were expecting, but all of the art and culture just died. You know, masterpieces were slithering down off the canvas and crawling across gallery floors towards the daylight like gorgeous dying jellyfish, and all the songs and pieces of music and perfect pop songs, they all kind of flew away in this incredible aviary jailbreak. And we sort of have, we present the Arts Lab gig that follows this introduction as, yeah, the traumatized survivors kind of got together in small groups and tried to articulate what it was that they'd lost. They tried to recreate this thing called art that they'd heard about, but only imperfectly understood. And then at the end of the evening, based upon the principle that in a political vacuum, you often get some political monster arising to take advantage of it. And I thought, well, in a cultural background vacuum, what if you get some kind of cultural monster? And I thought, yeah, and it would probably be a mandrill. I thought, if I was to dress up as a mandrill, a very well-dressed mandrill, but a mandrill nonetheless, some kind of fascist mandrill, and then deliver my address at the end of the evening, I can probably get a kind of a good Nuremberg rally vibe going. So this was how we celebrated the appalling fact that we'd somehow voted ourselves out of Europe, with me dressed as a mandrill and leading this torchlight rally almost. But a lot of the people who saw it, I think it kind of made them feel better. I think that they were smiling, they were thinking, if Alan Moore's prepared to dress up as a totalitarian mandrill, then I think everything's going to be all right. You know, I think I lent them reassurance.
Amazing.
So, but that's been great, Dan.
Thanks so much for that. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to episode 13 with Alan Moore. Thank you to Alan. He was amazing. Also, thank you to Mark and Jay, who run the Lodge Studios in Northampton. Alan's comic Providence is on episode 10. You should pick that up. There's actually a book compiling, I think, the first five, and then I guess there'll be more again. It's amazing. It's an incredible read. And his forthcoming novel, Jerusalem, is out in September, which is very soon. I think you can pre-order that online now. Remember to subscribe on iTunes, by the way, if you leave me a review and a rating. That would be wonderful because it makes a difference. The next episode is with Wes Borland of Queen Kwong, Limp Bizkit.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Blacklight Burns, and more. Thanks again. I'm out. Peace.